Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow, what an episode we have for y'all today.
Yes, we have a great episode with a guest who Shireen met on Instagram, but who's been listening to us for a while, but also lives in Colombia and is doing a lot of interesting work.
We're joined by Farhana Ali. She is incredible. I'm really excited for y'all to get to know her, so stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi.
Hi, Shireen. It's one of those days. I feel like our internets are slow because there's long gaps.
Yeah, like you keep, whenever you talk, mine goes on top for some reason, and I apologize for that. It's like there's a lag.
Let's see.
I'm sorry. There's I'll try to be conscious of stopping and starting. Also, just keep all of this in. This is the technical difficulties of Zoom, y'all. This is what you get.
Yeah, whatever. Our editor, Billy, makes everything great. There's a lag. That's what you do. You just yell at your boyfriend.
Talking to Zach.
There's a lag.
I see a partial Zach arm because Anna's background is always blurred out. Anyway, that one's gone.
To hide the mess.
I kind of like bringing up when we're recording this just so y'all know, but today is Thursday, May 27th, and we might be talking about some topical stuff, so just keep that in mind when this comes out of the date. I'll just bring in our guest. Is that?
Yes, please do. This intro is a mess.
So this guest, actually, I met through Instagram. She's doing really cool work. Her name is Farhana Ali. She's right here with us today. She's also currently located in Colombia, which is, if you might have heard, is going through their own turmoil down there and police brutality and all that stuff. So without further ado, please welcome Farhana Ali.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Yay.
How long have you been in Colombia?
3 months now. Okay. So it's the longest time that I've been abroad, actually.
Oh, wow. What brought you to Colombia?
Lots of reasons, actually. Right before the pandemic happened last year, I was separated from my partner and he had to come back to Colombia. And, things were slowly starting to get back to normal and things. And then I also started working online and earning an income online just freed up a lot of time for me to like just be here and, try out the digital nomad life, which was something I've always wanted to do. And I was like, all right, well, he's here and why not we do it? Like, let's just try. Mm-hmm. Let's see how it goes. See how I like it. So
nice.
Now, what is the digital nomad life for people who don't know?
It's just people who earn their income online. And so that gives them the freedom, location freedom, to be basically wherever they are at. So a lot of people, they tend to travel, especially abroad. They will tend to travel in other countries where the US dollar will go a lot farther somewhere. Mm-hmm. So you may not necessarily have to earn as much, or you can like afford a different lifestyle or a better lifestyle abroad and things like that. So that's part of the appeal.
I mean, it definitely has appeal for me. I also just like, I've always wanted to explore South America so badly, and Colombia is one of those places that just looks so beautiful. And I'm so glad I know you on Instagram now, because your posts are so beautiful when you're like hiking or just exploring. I really have to go down there and just explore. Obviously, when I don't want to just like now, whenever I hope that I'll go in like a more timely time. But it's really cool that you're able to explore different parts of the world while also like being financially stable. I think it's kind of rad.
Yeah, I'm really grateful that I was afforded this opportunity, honestly.
Nice. Yeah, that's true too. I guess last year was definitely a time where you're like, if I'm going to work from home, this is the time.
Yeah.
This is the time, honestly.
I'll just rewind for a second. So let's backtrack. We're not in Colombia. Tell us where you grew up, where you were born.
Yeah, so I was born in Malaysia. And it's not as fancy as it sounds because I literally moved to the US when I was 2 years old. So I'm more American than I am anything else. And I grew up in Los Angeles, went to school in Santa Barbara for a little bit, and then, you know, realized I had no idea what I wanted to study. So I moved back to Santa Monica, finished university in Long Beach, and then just kind of was like, what am I doing with this, my life? I hate this city. I just want to get out of here. So yeah. And then now I'm here. I grew up with Muslim parents, which is actually why I first started listening to your podcast. When I was living in Long Beach, I was working at a research institute in Dana Point. So if you guys are familiar with the area, Dana Point is not anywhere close to Long Beach at all. It's like all the way at the bottom of Orange County, super far. My commute was like an hour and a half one way. And at one point I was like, bro, I just hate listening to the same 10 songs. Like, what is this? So I'm like, all right, let me just try listening to some podcasts. And I actually heard an ad for your podcast in like one of my Spotify ads. And I started listening to it and I like got so hooked because I was like, I finally feel represented in a way that I never felt represented before. Because even though I grew up culturally Muslim, I don't identify as a Muslim at all. In the media, there's always just like, you're either super Muslim or you're not, like, at all. And I feel like I hold a lot of like the cultural Islamic parts, but like not the religious parts. I don't know. It's like a whole thing. But yeah, so I remember one day I was like driving and I'm like, I'm going to be a guest on their podcast one day. And like 3 years later.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It's called manifestation.
Yeah.
That's cool that we have ads. I have no idea what's going on with our show.
Yeah. I mean, that's really nice that you felt represented. I guess that was our goal all along. So I'm glad you found us because I think Anna and I both relate to like not really feeling 100% like religiously Muslim, but also just like culturally it's a part of us.
Yeah. I wish I was more Muslim though. I say that all the time. I read the prayers now just to read them because I have nothing else going on in my life. So now I'm just going to become like a devout Muslim at this point. I don't know if I will, but I was like talking to my mom the other day and I was like, should I become a devout Muslim? And she's like, you're not really the prototype we're looking for. That's like what she said without so many words. Like she was like, I don't know if that's your thing. And I was like, well, God damn it. What if I just like made it like a modern Muslim thing? I don't know. We'll see.
You have mentioned that you're like kind of becoming your mother as you get older. Like you've been noticing that you have these, maybe that's the next step, you know, becoming like your mother, a devout Muslim. I'm here for it.
God, but that's actually sounds really, when you say it that way now, I'm like, oh no.
I'm sorry.
Oh no. I'm going to be like praying five times a day, which is nothing wrong with it. But my mom's life seems so structured in a way that I'm like too exhausted. Like she gets up at like 5 a.m. to pray.
Right.
And yeah. I'll start at 10.
Morning prayer. But then you miss the time.
I know. You why it doesn't work for me really. But
yeah. I mean, you can add on to the afternoon one if you want, but it's. It's not as good, the opposite of haram, I don't know.
Also, you have to be somewhat flexible because my mom does lift her feet into the sink to wash them before because, you know, how to do the full washer. And every time she does, I'm like, you have the energy for that right now? You just lift your foot and put it in the sink? Like, come on. That's some, like, flexible old Muslim lady stuff. I don't have it. Sorry.
I'm always surprised by my parents. Like, it's like they'll just groan every time they sit on the couch, but then somehow they can lift their legs to the sink.
100%.
What?
100%. Yeah. That's really funny.
There you go.
Yeah.
I wish my mom was like as cool as yours, though, in terms of just like accepting that maybe you might not be as religious. I remember right before I came to Colombia, I told her like, yo, I'm not Muslim. Mm-hmm. And she didn't take it too well, as expected. And then like the day before my flight, she was like, what should I do with your body if you die? Because you're supposed to do like ghusl and like do the whole thing. And I was like, I don't know. You could just like toss me in the ocean or something. And she's like, that's not the answer I wanted. I'm like, bro, I don't know what to tell you. Like,
it's 2021. Right. Just cremate at this point. Like, if you don't know what to do with me, put me in a vase and then put me on the shelf. You know, put me in an ornate vase, put me on the shelf. And then there you go. Problem solved.
This is one of those things where I don't know if it's like a Muslim thing or like a Malaysian superstition thing, but they say like after you die, you can still feel pain. And I just don't want to take that chance.
Oh, God.
Yeah, as you said, there's a very specific ritual and tradition when it comes to Muslim mm-hmm. funerals and Muslim ceremonies. There's a very particular cloth you use. It's different if you're even, like, if you were killed, there's a different kind of way to do it, too. But, like, even me, my sisters and I all have tattoos, and technically, we can't be buried with our parents because of our tattoos. But I think, like, I would hope, as we're continuing into this new age, people are more open-minded, and good Muslim, in quotes, is more about who you are as a person rather than, like, if you cover your hair, if you have tattoos kind of thing. I can relate to your parents or your mom being disappointed because both my parents are pretty disappointed, but I like reclaiming the word Muslim just as a cultural thing because it is a part of me that it's like, I can't deny it, you know, like, and I think if someone can be culturally Jewish and religiously Jewish, I think the same can be said for Muslims, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I still don't eat pork. That counts mm-hmm. for something, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think so. There's also, and I'm sorry, this is such an aggressive stereotype, but there's a bit of a cheapness that comes when you're like a Middle Easterner or, you know, just like, I mean, to generalize, like just a brown person when you come, like there's a certain, and I don't even know if it's based in like Islam or anything. It's just like, it could be any religion, honestly, but it's something I've noticed in life just growing up around my family and friends and like friends and their families. And like my dad straight up, his best friend died and he cremated him. And then he was like, can you believe how much they're charging for these vases?
Oh my God.
No, 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 no. I'm not buying a vase for him. I will bring him home in a cardboard box and then I will go get a cheaper vase to put him in. And like, that's like the energy my dad was bringing to death of like, look, 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 look. It's too expensive to have you sitting in like an ornate vase. Okay. That's ridiculous. It's cheaper to bury you. Like that's the energy he was bringing. And like, that was kind of the energy I got from my family in Iran where they're like, cremate, that's expensive. We already have a plot of land. We'll just throw them in there. You know, like that's, I don't know if that's like a thing. Like they're just like, we can't really deal with that. Like maybe it's truly just my family, but like it was like, oh wow. Like I understand being cheap in like other regards, but like for burials and death right. and like cremation, like that's the lane you want to take where you're like, no, we'll do it our own way. We're not going to do this like modern cremate someone sort of thing.
Unpopular opinion. I definitely take that approach. Like the dude's already dead. I don't know. Like yeah. when I die, like do not spend money, please. Just like I said, toss me in the ocean. I'm good.
Yeah. That might be it. It's kind of silly to make people spend money on you when you're not here anymore. But I also understand like traditions and stuff. I don't know. I've never encountered the cheapness thing because like one of the pillars of Islam is like to donate your, like to give a part of your income to people in need.
But that's not cheapness. Because my family does yeah. the same thing. I mean like there will be like cheapness and straight up like capitalism, like how right. they spend their money. Like they won't, if they're like, okay, $10 more for insurance, they'll be like, whoa, I'm not made out of money. No insurance. You know, like stuff like that where it's just like, it's $10. It's not going to make that much of a difference. Where like, I've had to break those sorts of things in myself where they're like, for $10 more, you could actually get insurance for like, or even like Apple Care where they're like, for $100, 5 years, you won't have to pay anything. My dad refuses to even acknowledge that. But I'm really? Like, actually, that's like not a bad deal if it saves me money in the long run.
Yeah.
But like, that's the level of cheapness. But like, you know, like giving back, I don't consider that like a part of the cheapness thing, like stereotype.
I guess my dad is a little bit opposite of yours only because like, I don't know. I think like once he acquired any sort of income for himself, he was like, I have to make sure everything is protected kind of thing. My dad is a very like, in the best way possible, a very like righteous man. He gives a lot of his money to his family. So I don't know. I think it was just like, just different. I think it's just different. Different. What's it called? Different strokes for different folks. I don't know.
In the case of my parents, I definitely feel like my dad's the same in like, you know, he'll give like all of his money to like help people or things like that. But then they can also be super cheap. But I feel mm-hmm. like I have to understand too, like they came from a different time period mm-hmm, and right. they came from also a different country, a country yeah. that only recently got super hyper capitalized because of mm-hmm. like how globalized our world is. I feel like even though capitalism existed all over the world, you know, since the last century, the system worked in different ways. And in the US, you're taught to handle your money differently than you mm-hmm. were, you know, in abroad. So in Malaysia, like it's not like they were struggling necessarily in Malaysia. They were doing quite well, but they have a different relationship with money just because of, again, the culture, the religion, mm-hmm. the way that people thought about money over there. And they took it here, you know? So I don't really consider it being cheap. It's more like, what do you value? What do you value right. in spending? Mm-hmm. Like I'm super cheap. I think in like, I won't buy clothes for 5 years because I just don't feel like I need to or something like that. I don't know.
That's a good way to look at it, I guess. It's less the word cheap and more like, what are your priorities to spend your money on? What brought your parents to Malaysia?
We're ethnically Punjab. We're like ethnically Indian. And in every country, you're going to experience racism. So in Malaysia, there wasn't like a lot of opportunities for Indian people as much as, you know, what was touted in the US pre 9/11. So they, you know, my uncle, he actually went to university here at the University of Mississippi. So it was just easier for them to come and travel here. And Malaysia is like an ally of the US. It's just relatively easier for us to like have come here. So they decided to get settled here because they wanted to have better opportunities for my siblings and I.
That's how it goes.
A typical immigrant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Typical immigrant story.
Is that common? Were there a lot of other kind of like Punjabi people in that area, or your family just happened to go?
There's a lot of Indian people in Malaysia, but for some reason, my family is like one of the very few families that are North Indian.
Okay.
The people that usually are there are South Indian. So it's like culturally like super, super different from us. And now they have a huge immigration problem actually with Bengalis that are being displaced and going to Malaysia. So yeah, it is pretty common. Malaysia economically is, I would say, like second to Singapore. I mean, we do pretty well, and the like living standard there is pretty high.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, like refugees from the Philippines and Bangladesh and, you know, Myanmar and stuff, they tend to go there because it's easier to immigrate there than it is Singapore. So
interesting. Mm. I didn't know that, and I didn't know it was up there with Singapore either. That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. That's pretty high because Singapore is pretty well off. And also,
rich.
Isn't Islam like the most, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought it was the most prominent religion in Malaysia. Is that true?
Yeah. Malaysia is considered a Muslim country. And also just about like the Singapore comment, it's like the second strongest economy in Southeast Asia. But I don't think it's like close to Singapore. Like
you
Singapore
mean like in relation like, to immigrants from India, that's like the close, like other than Singapore.
Because in the region, you have like Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand. So compared to all those other countries, like Malaysia is like pretty good. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? But Singapore obviously is like next level.
Singapore looks so bougie, but I guess that's like what mainstream media has sold me.
I really don't like Singapore. I don't know.
Have you been there?
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't like cities. Like it just kind of like anything that's super concrete jungle just takes a life out of me. And it just makes me super depressed, which is why I needed to leave LA. So
yeah, I can relate to that. I feel like if I think about it too much, every city just is like a capitalist empire to me. And I'm just like, what am I doing here?
It does feel like Singapore kind of reminds me of like Dubai, where you're like, there's all this like rich culture but and like rich people, but then also like was built on the backs of like the poor, basically, who are probably underpaid to create these like massive structures that we all now like look at on Instagram, all lit up like, wow, I should go to Singapore. And you're like, oh, wait, there's like a complete understructure of like poverty that we're just ignoring because it's not cute to look at.
Mm.
Singapore also has one of the highest depression rates in the world, too, because of how like just the culture pushes people to like work in a certain way.
Yeah.
But to your point, Anna, like, I don't know if you guys saw the movie Crazy Rich Asians.
Mm-hmm.
That movie really like made me so upset because it completely ignored that there were like other racial groups in Singapore. And it was basically just switched white people for Chinese people. And then like the only Indian representation was just like two quiet guards in the background.
Yes.
I was like, what the fuck is this?
I had a lot of issues with that movie. And that was one of them, was just kind of like classist and strange. But enough about that. Let's take our first break. When we get back, let's get to know you more, ask you about your work and all that fun stuff. We'll be right back.
Okay, and we're back. So why did your parents choose like LA? Was there any other family here, or it's just kind of what happened?
Honestly, I don't even know. And I never really bothered to ask. So we just ended up in LA, I guess. I think part of it has to do with like, it's just a super diverse city and they hate the cold because we're from the tropics. So New York was out of the question.
And are those like the two big ones everyone knows about? I feel like everyone's always like Hollywood. Oh, I mean, it's in my experience in Iran, because they've never been out here. Like my family there is literally like, Hollywood, is that near New York? And I have to be like, yes, it is.
Same. My family's the same.
Like you just know the big hot spots when you're like from a different country and you're like, I'll go to what sounds nice, but I don't know anything really else. But yeah. LA is a good choice, I think, especially if you're trying to find a multicultural place that's like has so many different hubs.
Yeah, LA worked out good because there's like little India, you know, and then there's like a lot of mosques here. You can find a lot of like Asian supermarkets and stuff. So they felt more acclimated to this city, which I'm noticing is something I definitely took for granted now that I'm here. So,
yeah. My parents were the same. They lived in Anaheim for a long time. And Anaheim has like Little Arabia. A lot of people speak Arabic. So many good like Arabic stores and shops and just like mosques and everything. But I think that was a big reason why. Because my dad went to different cities. And when he landed in LA, he was like, the weather I like is here. This is what I grew up with. People are speaking to me in Arabic. Sign me up. So that sealed the deal for him too.
I think it's definitely easier for brown people, I think, in LA. LA is pretty much just brown people, let's be honest.
Yeah, we're overtaking the population and I'm very happy about it. Let me ask you about your work. So you mentioned that you work digitally and you did mention like you didn't really know what you wanted to do in college. So how did you find your path as far as like what you do now? And how did you like kind of navigate not knowing what you wanted to do to now what you do?
Okay, so to backtrack, I ended up going to a community college so I could take just a bunch of classes. And I realized that I fell in love with politics. I think also just growing up as an immigrant that was undocumented for a pretty long period of my life, I was just very aware of the fact that how policies directly affected me. So that kind of made me super interested in politics. And I also fell in love with the environment because I realized, like, you know, just from studying philosophy and things, how much nature impacts us spiritually, how much nature impacts us like mentally and things like that. So I double majored in the two. And as people with both environmental science and political science degrees, you're just like, there's not really like one pathway that you kind of go with. I ended up getting a job at a lab where I tested the environmental quality and things for the area in Orange County. And it was a pretty good job. But honestly, I felt really unhappy there because I was just stuck in a lab from 7:30 to sometimes 6 or 7 p.m. at night. Like during the winter time, I never even saw sunlight. And over the weekends, you know, that's when you usually have time to like go and do stuff for yourself. I was either running errands or I was just too tired to like do anything. So I was really unhappy. And so I went back into like bartending and just like more gig economy things. I drove Uber for a little bit or whatever because I just prioritized my time a lot more. But I knew like, okay, so this is not sustainable. Like this is not, you know, my end goal. Like you are able to do more than this. And so with the pandemic last year, you know, it really gave me the opportunity to kind of sit down and figure out, okay, what the heck do you want to do? And so I've always been really good with computers. I've always been really passionate about photography and video editing and just anything in that creative side. And so I decided to start up my own virtual assistants company. I got some clients and it's been pretty good. Like it's sustainable. I earn an income. It's nothing glamorous, but it's a good job that I feel like I can continue on for a career, at least for some time. But I knew that at the end of the day, I also wanted to do something that I was like passionate about, which is why I started Earth's Narrative, because I realized that whenever we talk about the environment, we're always kind of shifting the conversation to the individual, or like what the individual can do, what the individual is responsible for. And it always ends up being this really superficial situations of like, get a reusable water bottle, mm-hmm. or, you know, go thrift shopping and things. And like, those are important, but policy is what changes things at the end of the day. And that's what I wanted to cover with Earth's Narrative, is I wanted to cover the political side of the environment and the political side of how our governments handle the climate crisis. And the more that I learn about it, the more that I educate myself about it, the more I realize like how much shit we have to fix, actually, because it's deeply, deeply ingrained in us from like just our colonial history, our lack of social justice, our lack of recognition of people. It's like a whole thing. So yeah, that's basically what I do with Earth's Narrative, is I talk about politics, the environment, and people.
I feel like we also have like the issue with recycling in cities. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not really happening. That's really wild. We just think we're recycling, but then like the city's not really doing the full work of actually recycling, which is why I think a lot of cities now, I noticed this first in Berlin, you just like leave your cans and glassware, whatever, right next to the trash can. Like, you don't put it in the trash can. You don't even put it in a recycling bin. You leave it out so people can pick it up and, you know, turn it in and make money off of it. And I think that should be more common of a thing, instead of being like, I'm recycling these cans. I'd be like, no, just like leave them out for the people who want to come and collect them, because they're actually taking them to direct recycling centers and making money off of it. That, you know, we're like just giving, or we're throwing, literally we're like throwing away, because like how much, especially in LA, like it took a long time for my building to have a separate recycling bin. And they were like, no, it gets separated once it gets to the facility. And I was like, I don't believe you at all. So I think we should be like giving it to the people who want to go and actually recycle and make the money off it, especially people who like, that's how they make literally an income or living, an external living outside of whatever maybe their actual job is for their family.
Yeah. I like that like a lot. Berlin. I like that. Because like then you're just helping people, right? Like if you don't trust the actual facilities, because things can get so easily contaminated and stuff. So sometimes a whole batch is thrown away because of like one thing that should have been there.
Yeah. Also, like, don't make people like have to dig through your shit. Just like leave it out for them. Be like, this is for you. Here's a box. Just take it.
I like that. I also like what you said, Farhana, about like those little things that people think they're doing, like not using plastic straws or getting a reusable water bottle or thrifting. Like, those are all very important things, but you're right. Like, to implement actual change and to help the environment, we need to look at the policies, and we can't just do these things that like maybe give us a pat on the back, you know? Like, it's more like to feel good about yourself at the end of the day, because you're not really helping in the long term.
Yeah, but, and I think it also becomes extremely commercialized. Like, capitalism always finds a way. So people stopped using plastic straws, and now you have restaurants implementing paper straws, which, okay, where are you getting that paper? That's still a use of resources, you know? Or the metal straws. Oh, the metal straws just really get to me, because like I always see sorority girls and shit like, oh my gosh, I'm being so environmental. I'm like, bro, those are still resources. And I get that straws are helpful to like a certain community that have trouble drinking and stuff. But it's just like, we need to change our mindset that we don't actually need a lot of the things that we think we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did like what you said about capitalism always finds a way. That is so true.
Yeah, actually, I just remembered. So the concept of the carbon footprint was created by BP. So they created this concept to blame environmental damage on us. So they're like, well, lessen your fucking carbon footprint if you want to stop making the world die, versus like being like, okay, but what about you and that oil? Mm-hmm. Like they literally, I think it was in the 80s or maybe early 90s, they created that. So even the concept of the carbon footprint was created out of capitalism to basically trick us into believing we are the problem.
And we have to do things instead of actually holding the higher ups accountable. You know what I mean? It's the same, like, I'm not surprised, which is sad, but just like, the tobacco industry. They're the ones that also blame the consumer and also are like putting out anti-smoking ads. You know, it's at the end of the day, it's all about fucking capitalism. And it's just, it's a plague. It's okay. It's just.
It was in 1971.
Wow. Wow. That's a long game.
They said it was an incredible manipulative tactic. They had a Native American man like crying on screen, being like, how could you have done this? Lessen your carbon. So they went for it. They were like, right. Find a person that will speak to people's hearts. Throw a bag of trash on the ground. And then their catch line was, people start pollution, people can stop it.
Fuck you.
Pretty cool.
Also, when you make the conversation about the individual person and what they're capable of doing, like, there's a lot of communities that can't afford to take more sustainable actions. Like, they just genuinely can't afford to do it. And so then the blame starts to shift on these like POC, BIPOC minority communities, and it starts to shame them when capitalism literally started fundamentally through like a system of neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. So I think about like the vegan industry and how there's always these shaming of, you know, like if you're able to be vegan, that's great and wonderful. And I'm not saying like, don't be a vegan, but there's some people that genuinely can't afford a vegan diet. Like they can't afford to feed their family of four in Los Angeles on a vegan diet when everything is priced so high, or if they're living in a food desert. That's not even to think about the global South. That's another thing too, where it's like countries in Europe or the US will turn to developing nations and say, hey, you're the problem. You're the one that's causing all of this pollution because you're building all these industries, and they don't even look that we had two industrial revolutions. Like we also had our own part when we literally raped and reaped all the resources from these countries and then turned around and told them, you can't do the same thing that we did. So yeah. It's so frustrating. It's so frustrating.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I'm not speaking for all vegans, but like I really feel lucky that I live in a city that makes it so easy for me to be vegan. But at the same time, I really despise how you eat and like health and everything. It's become so elitist. Like taking care of yourself has a price point at this point. And like that's a crime. Like the fact that like a less fortunate family can't just like get healthy food because it's priced at a point that like they can't afford. It makes me so upset.
And they live in areas where grocery stores aren't even like available to
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
So.
Health food's not really like a thing mm-hmm. in more marginalized communities. You're just like, I'm eating to survive.
Exactly.
My survival children are eating beans priority. Because we need yeah. carbs, because we need to, you know, live. Like, there's no like, I'm cutting down to keto. I'm actually going to burn fat. And I'm going to eat less carbs. It's like, it's not really, you don't just get to do that.
Yeah, there's not like
everything's
that
so expensive.
Privilege of choice. You're just trying to survive, right? And I think as long, if you have the privilege of making choices and being aware of what you're doing, like, yeah, cut down on your red meat, cut down on like things that destroy the environment, like factory farming and all that stuff, you know? But a lot of people, like Anna said, like they don't have that privilege of choice. And so policy has to be implemented to make grocery stores available to people that are surrounded by fast food restaurants. You know, I think we're not tackling the actual problem if we shame people or be like, this is why you're unhealthy or like XYZ. Because yeah, at the end of the day, it's about survival.
Yeah, exactly. Like shaming doesn't get anybody anywhere. And it also like, again, shifts the blame on the individual, which is what they want you to do. They like that is always what politicians, they don't want to invest in water infrastructure. They don't want to invest in healthier options because it takes money. It takes mm-hmm. money out of their pockets. And let's be honest, our entire government system is extremely corrupted and takes money only from super PACs and things like that. So when you get distracted, that's when they win. And mm-hmm. I feel like these culture wars that are constantly happening, you know, that's just a huge distraction from what we actually need to implement, what we actually need to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's great living here. Everything is the worst. Everyone sucks. And I hate this country more than ever now yeah. because
oh,
there is no way to get any accountability for anything.
No. It just becomes clear by the day, by the year that all governments, all politicians, at the end of the day, they value capitalism above all else. They will support a company before supporting the people. Like, McDonald's has to make money. Okay, let's open another one across the street versus a health food store or some shit. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it just drives me crazy.
Literally was just reading that they're going to help bail Bezos's space program out while he's like buying MGM for like $1 billion or whatever. It's like, well, sounds like he's got money. He's just not spending it in the right place.
Yeah,
and then they're like, shut up, person. Shut up, human.
Honestly,
on this
just
planet.
Get like VR and call it a day. Like, you can go to space.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, you're not in the space race, bro. Like,
right.
Get the fuck out of here. You don't need this.
So it makes me so mad. These fucking cis rich white men just destroying the fucking world. Like, it's. Ugh,
but
and
then
they're
to think,
so greedy.
What
and
a
hoarding.
Dream. What a dream to be that man. Just destroying the planet as you go.
It'd be great to be a white man.
Yeah. And then having the nerve to be like, vaccines or whatever the fuck. You know, like that's the privilege of a person who's like, I am slowly destroying the planet. But no, I will not put a vaccine in my body. My body is a temple. This planet, burn it to the fucking ground, though. And you're like, oh, cool. Must be nice.
Yeah.
For me, it's Joe Rogan saying at one point, white men are going to be silenced forever. Like, bro, get the fuck
Which
out
is
of
like
here.
Also,
you have the biggest.
Oh my God.
What a dream. Garbage. We should silence white guys.
Yeah.
I don't see a problem with that.
When I saw the headline, I was like, yes, dream come true. Thank you. Like, what are you saying?
So you agree with us.
Yeah.
So you agree. White guys should be silenced.
Exactly. 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 I don't know. I just hate the concept of billionaires and the fact that billionaires exist and that like in the past year they just became richer and now it's like 7% of billionaires have like most of the nation's money or the world's money. It's just, that's a crime and we can't do anything about it. And it feels like we can't anyway. Like, they're never going to be held accountable because capitalism. Like, I don't know.
Capitalism's fun. I'm having a good time.
Let's take our second break and we'll be right back. I want to get into some stuff that's happening in Colombia. Don't go anywhere. Okay, we are back with Farhana Ali. You've been posting a lot, as we all should, about what's happening in Colombia and stuff, and you definitely have a different perspective being on the ground there, but what has, and just so you know, I mean, this is such a condensed summary, but Colombia has been going through a lot of economic turmoil. It started a couple years ago and it kind of has escalated in recent months and the past year. Initially, Colombians were protesting a tax bill, and because of all the protests, it initially was shut down, but the protests continued because it was more of like this accumulation of like economic outrage and a lot of policies that were helping the people. And so in the past year, in these protests, similar to what happened last year with American protests, police presence at these protests started to become really intense. And there was a lot of instances of police brutality, some deaths even. And so that made the protests even more relevant. So more people started showing up and it's still going on now. Police brutality is a huge issue there. Same with America, same with Palestine and Israel, because guess what? All those weapons come from the same place, aka America. But yeah, that's just a rough summary. But what's your experience been like the past few months?
Yeah, so the protests really started happening back up again last month, which is when Duque, the president of Colombia, decided to introduce the tax bill that would raise the taxes for just ordinary things like milk, bread, eggs, you know. And like you said, Colombia has been going through a lot of economic turmoil in the last year, especially with the pandemic and not receiving any help from the government. It's been long known that the government has been, you know, tied to like organized crime and things like that. So they're not particularly inclined to help their people. And Colombia is one of the most unbalanced economically country in South America. So when the protests originally started to happen, I actually went with my partner to the first protest. And I had thought it was going to be like something like the BLM protests that I went to in LA, which were huge and big and you know, really incredible because there were like community leaders and people talking, and it was like you felt like you were really part of something. And in over here, it was like I genuinely feared for my life. Whoa. There were, as soon as we got there, there were police that were already tear gassing people. Oh. There were bombs being thrown. There were like guns being shot. It was,
oh my God.
There was at one point that it was so crazy because there was just this huge metal fence that they have. It's like an art piece, really. And people were breaking that fence down so that they could use it as a shield. And all you could hear was the bang, bang, bang of the fence. But then like you'd hear the bombs in the background and you'd hear people screaming and running. And then there was this guy with a huge boombox playing Bohemian Rhapsody. And so it was so, I just felt like I was in an apocalyptic movie. I was like, what the hell is this? And I remember they set the city on fire and it was really intense. And that was the first day. Wow. So yeah. So my partner and I decided to stay in, obviously, for the following consecutive days. So we're in Cali, and Cali is actually known as Corazón de la Resistencia, which is the heart of the resistance. Like the major, major stuff happened in Cali, and the most police brutality actually happened in Cali. So after that weekend, there was another huge protest, but this one was just like a really big block party. Like the entire city showed up and there was music and food and everything. It kind of like made it feel like things were better. And then on Monday, you started hearing about people going missing, people getting raped by the police, getting shot. There was a video that surfaced 5 days ago or something where this girl was being dragged by five police and it was said that she got raped and then she killed herself after that. And she was only 17 years old. And that honestly was just like super disheartening, obviously, for anybody with a heart to see. And the president, he didn't really have any intentions of diffusing the tension or doing anything, really. He stated that he was going to renounce the tax bill, but then reintroduced it into a healthcare bill. So the same money would be like, it didn't really change anything financially. So that is actually why people continued to protest. And the protesters were mostly teenagers. They were teenagers. Those are the people, like poor teenagers. And those are the people that are getting killed out in the streets. Those are the people that are getting injured. As of May 12th, there were 42 people confirmed dead and over 200 people confirmed missing. It just keeps getting worse from there. I remember we actually flew out of the city to visit a place for the weekend. And when we came back, we couldn't even take the same route back because there was like, they were doing laser signs showing like, yo, there's like danger here. You can't even go through here. And everything kind of closes at night. It's been really weird. Honestly, you feel the tension in the city and you feel like the danger. And at the same time, like people are trying to have some sense of normalcy. So yeah, it's been an experience. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up that 17-year-old girl. When I heard about that, I could not shake that out of my brain. Like, she was seen on a video, dragged off by, I think it was four or five police officers. And she told everyone she was, like, literally raped and nothing happened about it. And then she took her own life. I heard after that happened, the protests escalated. And then another 22-year-old man, he was hit in the neck by a tear gas grenade and he was killed. I'm just going to read some numbers here just so you guys get an idea, because the disappearances are very troubling. So according to rights groups, up to 548 people have disappeared since the protests began on April 28th. And as you said, 42 civilians have been killed as of May 12th. And only one of them is a police officer. The rest are civilians. And a lot of NGOs are saying that the death toll is probably underreported and the figures probably are much higher. There are over 1,800 cases of police violence and excessive force. So, like, hundreds of injuries, and only three officers have been charged in quotes so far. They'll probably not do anything. And again, very brief summary, but it's really important to pay attention to what's going on down there, because both Palestine and Colombia are victims of U.S. imperialism, because they heavily armed both of those, like both of the militaries in Israel and Colombia, and they just like bounced and like creating all this. It's just the United States sucks, man.
Yeah. I definitely agree with the underreporting thing, because I've noticed too that there's not a lot of like coverage of Colombia in English. A lot of it has been in Spanish. So it's definitely more difficult for people who don't speak Spanish to. And I think that's why a lot of people actually resonated with my post. I did not expect it to get as much traction, but when it was first happening, like people needed like English resources, and the government actually turned off the, like, I don't know how you're able to do this, but, like, turned off the data off your phones and stuff, essentially silencing Colombians.
That happens a lot.
So there's like actually a lot of video footage, a lot of footage. I have a friend that was like there when they shot someone, and it's just not being reported. In Colombians, you don't see them on social media. You don't see them on, you know, on anything unless you already follow them. And I also have a lot of friends here that have told me that their posts have not been able to go through, or they've been deleted and things like that. So there's definitely like very heavy censorship that's happening too. And I think it's really unfortunate. The Palestinian and Israeli conflict has been happening forever. And then, you know, because it got so much traction too, people have started to kind of forget about Colombia, because it's definitely less on the radar for a lot of people. So it's just, it makes me so sad, because they both deserve the same amount of attention, I feel like. And there's just so much injustice in the world that, like, how can you have the capacity to really deal with so much, you know what I mean? So that's the really distressing part for me about that. So
yeah
I mean, that's the problem, is like, you know, like Iran will turn the internet off in the country and be like, good luck telling anyone what's happening. And that's what happens. These countries have such a power hold, and like the U.S. is fucking useless literally when it comes to these sorts of things, because one, they find a reason to be like, we really can't get involved, or they'll sell you weapons. And it's just like, there's no rhyme or reason. Like, they just can't help people of color at all. Like, they're just no interest in giving a fuck about people of color, especially if they're from a country that does not give America anything money-wise. So if we're not growing shit in your country and getting a kickback off that, stop expecting us to do anything for you. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a whole nother level of censorship. That shit's wild. I mean, ever since the, you know, like people have been posting about Palestine, like the work the Israel lobby is doing to silence like pro-Palestinian activists, unreal. I mean, like, basically, like, it's just America. Because these are people who are in D.C. working their ass off to silence Americans who are pro-Palestinian, so they can't say anything. And I can't even imagine what it's like to be a Palestinian right now, living in Gaza or, you know, in the West Bank, just trying to get your information out there, because they know who you are and they're watching you at all times, and they'll come and kill your family. Like, and half the time you're expecting to die. Like, you're just ready to die because you're being vocal. Yeah. And no one will give you a job because they're like, oh, you're a little too vocal. Like, it's just fucked up. Like, the plight of being a person of color is so dismissed of, like, every day I wait to die. Like, literally. And that, and they're just like, oh, shut up. You're so annoying. You're being too much. And it's like, yeah, well, sorry, I don't want my family and friends to be murdered in broad daylight by the corporate institutions and government institutions that are supposed to technically exist to protect us. But God forbid I look up to anyone, because it's all about yourself. You can't ask anyone for help because your skin color is not white enough, or you don't speak English good enough, or whatever bullshit excuse they make to disregard your life.
It's so incredible to me the influence that Israel has too on just like Americans. I mean, Bernie Sanders had to pull back the bill that he was proposing for not selling the weapons to Israel. And then Carlo also going back on his tweet, and I'm just
fucking
like,
trash.
What?
At the end of the day, it's about money. They're spineless, because at the end of the day, there's something, they have chosen something in their mind that is more important than speaking up for an oppressed people. Which is so disgusting when I really think about it. Like, I don't, like, if you're choosing like a Marvel contract versus literal genocide, like speaking about genocide, like fuck you. That's another story. But to like piggyback off of what Anna was saying, I feel like the double-edged sword of social media is that, like, one, we would have never gotten this far when it comes to Palestine or even Colombia if people, like, didn't have, like, or even last year with BLM. And, like, if there wasn't a video of George Floyd's murder, we wouldn't have even known about it. And even if there was, like, there literally was, it was still went to trial and people had to, like, question, like, was he murdered? Anyway, but so the double-edged sword of social media is that, like, we're getting more proof of these crimes than ever before, especially in Palestine, but then we're getting censored. Like the Middle East, I mean, there are so many corrupt governments, like Syria is the same way, Iran's the same way. They like look through your phone, see if you've done anything, and if you have, your family's at risk. But it's so much more scary in Palestine right now. And I also agree with you. I think people are being very loud for the first time about Palestine. And I do think that Colombia has gotten a little bit overlooked, especially knowing now that like they're going through the same kind of censorship and they've literally blocked data. Like that makes so much sense now. Like if like also just the news here is reporting on fucking stupid shit like Ben Affleck and J-Lo. Like I don't fucking give a shit. Like I want to learn what's going on in the world. But yeah, I do. That's why I kind of want to keep the conversation going, because even though there's so much injustice in the world, I do think people, when they realize that, they're like, well, I can't do anything about it. I might like, how many causes should I care about? But we just have to keep fighting, because if we don't do it, no one will.
That's what I think, too, though, about social media is if you have that mentality where it's like, well, how many causes should I like keep thinking about? Then you're definitely in a space of privilege, because then you could just switch it off at any time. And I just feel like the world right now is, the world has always been an extremely violent place, but you're right. Like we're able to see it in front of our faces, like day in and day out, what's happening. Like I literally saw a tweet of a family in Palestine trying to celebrate a birthday amongst like rubble, and it just fucking broke my heart. So it's like, if you can look at that in your feed and still not feel compelled to do something, and I get not everybody necessarily needs to post on their social media, but there's so many other actions you can do. You can donate, you can talk to your friends and family, you can talk to your community, you can volunteer, you can, you know, reach out, you can like talk about voting and things like that that might help, that could help, you know. And yes, like you don't necessarily, it's hard. You can't possibly, you know, help every single situation. But if you're not even talking about it, because I know so many people that are like, when the BLM protests were happening, her biggest one person I knew, her biggest concern was that she couldn't like go out on the streets anymore because it was unsafe. And I'm just like, imagine not being able to go out on the streets ever because a cop might fucking shoot you. Like it's bigger than that. And I think right now I really appreciate independent media, like again, like podcasts like these or the Young Turks or The Hill, you know, or Crooked Media with their Pod Save America podcast, which I really also enjoy, that they're able to get the information out. So you literally have no excuse. You have zero excuses. If you have a cell phone, you need to be informed. And it, and I just don't have the patience for people who are like, I prefer not to get political. Like you can fuck off.
I'm so done with those people. Like it is such a privilege to only be concerned with things that directly affect your life. It is such a privilege to pick and choose what humans matter to you. Like that is enraging to me. And I think both Anna and I have like reached our limits with people that are silent, like especially because I feel like both Colombia and Palestine, they're relying on people on social media to share what's going on because it's not being reported. And like the one thing people are asking of you is to spread awareness on social media. And if you and that's the easiest thing you can do. And if you can't even do that, like, I don't give a shit about your frivolous, vapid life. Like, it means nothing to me if you don't give a shit about anything but yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a low cost thing to do. It's such a low cost thing to literally like just share an infographic. It's so easy.
Yeah. It's an interesting time knowing like who sucks.
Yep. People are showing themselves. People are really showing themselves for who they are. My friends, I have people I consider really good friends of mine aren't doing shit. Like, it's enraging to me. Not caring about other people really blows my mind. It just seems like a faraway problem. Like, both of them. Like, they're just like, what can I do all the way over there? Or like, every, like, what, how many causes should I care about? People are suffering everywhere. It's like, yeah, that's true. And it's only going to get worse when you're fucking silent. Like,
yeah. But I honestly, I refuse to feel dejected that there are so many people that are like that, because I really think that they are in the minority, even if they are a loud minority, because I feel that a lot of people, once they learn about the issues, like for me specifically, like I know a lot of my own personal friends did not know what was happening in Colombia, but then they saw I was like constantly posting about it over and over again. They saw I was like raising money and helping people. And I was so overwhelmed by the response that I got from people and just like how far it reached out. And it's really just a matter of like educating the people that want to know. And like, if we spent, and you know, it's like, this is like the Democratic strategy of they always try to like convert the Republicans to vote Democrat, right? Where they should be like focusing on the people that could potentially vote for them. And I think it's the same thing where it's like, I'm not going to focus on the person that doesn't give a fuck, because I don't give a fuck either. Like you said, your vapid life, just keep it to yourself. But if there's someone that wants to learn, that is genuinely concerned and needs, wants to know how they can help, but they don't know how to start, like we can have a conversation there.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. I was surprised by the certain few people that like reached out to me. I was like, oh, okay, you're interested.
Yeah, same.
Interested in understanding. Yeah. Like, there, someone just sent me something like, okay, like, I have a friend who just posted this, like, really pro-Israel thing. Can you please, like, I don't want to, like, fall for this classic propaganda. Like, explain to me exactly. And I'm, like, fine with doing that. Like, if you don't understand, like, why something, like, isn't, in our opinion, right? Like, the language they're using, like, just ask. Like, I'm more than willing to explain why Hamas is not the problem. Like, I'm saying it over and over and over again in my posts, but if it still doesn't compute to you and you need to literally just be like, I need help understanding, just ask. Because you know what? I know it's like our job to educate everyone, but sometimes I'd rather educate someone than like have them be like, I don't know, sounds like it's a both sides problem.
Right.
It's like, fine. If that's the case, then fine. I will tell you, and I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be my, you know, part to have to educate you. But I understand that, you know, I've gotten to a point where I understand this country is trash and we will all burn alive. So if I have to, then fucking fine, I will. And then, you know, one more person has a better understanding of the genocide that's happening.
That's a good point. I have really appreciated the response that I have gotten too, from people I don't know to like very close friends of mine saying like, I've learned so much XYZ. Like, I'm so like, thank you for continuing to post. So in those moments where I'm directing all my anger at like, yeah, you're right, like a selected minority in my head of people that I'm really disappointed in, I think those messages are really like an indicator of like, okay, I'm doing something here. Like, people are learning maybe for the first time about something. And that's important. Like, that's like, I mean, again, what Anna said, like, it's kind of exhausting to always be an educator. I mean, I can't even imagine what every person of color feels, like every Black person feels in America. Like, it's just exhausting to constantly have to remind people that your life matters. But at the end of the day, if we can convince a few people, like those people on the fence that just need to be taught, or like given tools to teach themselves, that's all I have to remind myself that, like, the people that are in the minority, the people that aren't going to learn, you can't do anything to help them. There's not a good likelihood that I can convince a Zionist that what they're doing is terrible, you know? Like, but I can convince
someone. Trash humans.
Yeah, exactly. But I can convince someone that is maybe questioning what Zionism is. Like, one of my really good friends texted me being really honest about, like, her Zionist upbringing and how my posts have, like, taught, like, helped her to kind of like unlearn that, and she felt a lot of shame for having taken this long to really understand that. But I really appreciate her vulnerability there. Like, those are the responses that really matter to me. So
I think the problem with Israel and Colombia, one thing that they share is that they have a lot of state propaganda data that's helping them. This whole idea of like, it's a complicated issue. It's not really a complicated issue. Like, I remember growing up thinking it was a complicated issue, and I took a minute to just like a minute to fucking read it. I'm like, this isn't complicated. And for Colombia too, I remember like there was a couple of people that were like, oh, well, aren't the, because instead of Hamas, they have the guerrillas, right? Which are like part of like the narco traffic population and things. And it's like, think about how the guerrillas started. They were literally just freedom fighters trying to fight for their own rights in a country that completely denied them. Yeah. So when you turn your finger at these terrorist organizations, like the US loves to turn their finger on ISIS, which I'm not condoning anything ISIS does. But bro, like ISIS happened because you bombed Iraq for like 10, also over created, a decade.
Also like created and like very much helped by the US. You know what I mean? Like
exactly.
It was... I mean, like, and look at the, I mean, to bring it back to the United States, like, the Black Panther Party was considered a terrorist organization.
Exactly.
Literally.
Yeah, it's just because, insurgents. Insurgents are created when they have nothing left. It's like, why do you think Hamas bombs or shoots rockets at Israel? Like, just
because
think about it.
They're fucking trapped, bro. Like, they don't have anything else. They don't even have a government. Like,
they're doing it to defend Palestinians. Yeah. They don't just, I mean, like, why do you think like people will just take it? You're like, I can't believe they're shooting back. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah.
And
that's
I will
what
say
happens.
That, yeah. I will say that a lot of Palestinians, and like also like people don't always agree with Hamas. Even Palestinians, they don't stand with Hamas. But you have to understand that like when you're pushed against a wall, that's where you have to fight back, and you're not allowed, if you're not allowed to have a military or have any type of protection. I just think people are so quick to point the finger at brown people so quickly.
Yeah.
And it just is really frustrating to me. And I really hope that more awareness starts to be spread about Colombia in particular, because you're right. Like, I didn't hear a lot about it until a couple of posts that I saw on Instagram. And then I did some research and I was like, this is completely similar to what happened last year, to what's happening in Palestine. And it's just like, and again, the root cause of all this evil is usually U.S. imperialism and that garbage.
I don't want to say it's just U.S. imperialism, because honestly, I don't want to let Europe off the hook. I feel like Europe gets off the hook a lot, and it just fucking pisses me off. Like, the British will turn around and be like, oh, we're so much better than you.
That's
like,
very true.
You started colonialism, and France is still accepting a colonial tax from like 14 different African nations today. So
also, they're very xenophobic and Islamophobic. Like, that's a very good point.
Isn't there a hijabi ban in France right now and shit? Like, bro, like,
there really is.
Yeah, because people are always like, oh, the US, US, the US. And it's like, yeah, the US fucking sucks. But Europe, you're not any better. And you're just kind of like, I'm just going to stand on the sidelines. Like, what the fuck are you doing for Colombia and Palestine? Like, you're not doing shit. And you're part of the UN. Like, you can help.
The British destroyed the world. I will go on record saying that. The British destroyed the Middle East, so much of the world. And I think I'll reword that. It's not U.S. imperialism. It's white imperialism. There.
Just close. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, don't forget, the British was the one that put Israel in Palestine after World War II. So,
I'll
like,
never forget. Winston Churchill is literally a demon to me. Like, he is the spawn of evil. Like, I will never forgive anyone for the people that implemented the Balfour Declaration and the people that just allowed Palestine to just become something else. If there is a hell, they're all there.
Anyone who has contributed to the global south can rot in hell. Like, honestly, like, we don't have to be as technologically advanced as we are if it meant at the expense of other people, but that's where we're at right now. So
are we gonna die? Are we gonna die? That's my only concern.
We are gonna die, actually.
We're all gonna die. I guess we should have to do stuff that matters before then. But
lots of drugs.
I mean, I'm microdosing as we speak. No, I'm serious. Anyway, but yeah, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate your time and your work and your activism and what you're doing with Earth's Narrative too. I think it's really important to
thank you so much.
Yeah, remind everyone that the Earth is the only thing we really have. We should protect it.
Yeah,
and go get vaccinated.
Yes, please.
Yeah, definitely. I have to do that as soon as I get back. Everyone's been asking me, "Have you been vaccinated?" I'm like, not yet, but it's only because I haven't been in the States.
Right. Because nope. it's not possible in Colombia.
It's not even possible for Colombians right now. I think it's so weird. Their age group is like 80 plus. And I mean, I don't want to be an ageist, but I'm like, that's really old. Like, I feel like they should be like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. They should at least open it up to like 65 up, because those people are still just as susceptible.
That's so vulnerable. Annoying.
Yeah.
Also, the U.S. hogged all the vaccines anyway. Mm-hmm. So there's another way we're killing everybody.
Yeah. Look at India, you know, like.
Yeah. Actually, I read somewhere that China sold a bunch of vaccines to Pakistan and like it ended up just being water.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It was like in the Malaysian news. So I don't know. But I was like, what the? I was like, why is this not getting more international press? Like, that's so fucked up. But it's Pakistan, so who cares, right? Right.
Wow. That's interesting.
Fucking criminals.
Yeah, they don't really report on stuff like that, but I am curious. If that's
That's worth looking into for sure, and worth talking about, you know. But yeah, thank you so much for being on our show. For those that don't know, where can people find your work and your stuff on the internet? Please just plug away.
So you can find me on Instagram, Farhana_Ali_, and then you can also find Earth's Narrative on Instagram at Earth's Narrative, and I also have a website, earthsnarrative.com. I also want to say, for anyone that is interested in learning stuff that's happening on the ground in Colombia and it's in English, a really great Twitter account is Colombia Reports. I think you guys should go check him out, because he does like honestly hourly updates on what's happening, and it's like really good journalism. So, and it's all in English, so it's accessible for anyone that doesn't speak Spanish.
Colombia Reports.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that is Colombia with two O's. Colombia with a U.
Colombia.
Yeah, exactly.
I did look it up. Apparently, there was a guy, Kong Mao, who made $2.8 million by selling 58 syringes of salt water.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fuck you, man.
But China's apparently prosecuting him.
Yeah, I hope he fucking goes to jail. What a fucking criminal.
How do you even get away with that?
I just wonder,
do governments normally buy syringes and vaccinations from not other governments? Like, is this like an individual man?
Maybe if he had like official backing, or he seemed legit or something. Like, he just sounds like a con artist. So he probably conned his way into seeming credible, you know? God.
That fucking sucks.
Fucking garbage.
Yeah, I'd have to look into it further, but what a great scam.
Scam goddess, where you at? This is for you. But yeah, thank you so much, everyone that's listening. If you are trying to learn about Colombia and you're on Twitter, please follow Colombia Reports, and also just like keep spreading awareness, because again, people are being silenced, people are being censored, and it's up to us to keep the conversation going, because all of these things haven't stopped just because you haven't heard about them. But yeah, I'll close this out. This is Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on... I keep glitching, man. Shirohiro on Instagram is Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosey on Twitter. Find us. Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.